From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Paris's Notre Dame Cathedral burned for more than 12 hours yesterday. Its spire and entire roof were destroyed, but its twin medieval bell towers and exterior walls stand. A team of investigators are looking for the cause, and art experts are converging on the scene to remove unburned paintings that likely suffered smoke damage. We'll have the latest right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. You're listening to the Santa Monica High School Choir in Notre Dame Cathedral as they were performing just a few days ago, the choir on tour, visiting Paris. And in fact, Arlea Lowenstein of Film Week, the parent of Ava, who's one of the performers in that choir. Lael joins us along with Ava from Paris to talk about the performance and the aftermath of the devastating fire, which burned for 12 hours yesterday, doing substantial damage to Notre Dame Cathedral. Lael, thank you for joining us, late afternoon there in Paris. Share with us what it was like for you having Ava perform there and then just a short time later this fire break out.
Well, the performance at Notre Dame was just exquisite. It was a real sort of vision quest for me. My mother was a musician and studied the harp in Paris. And I've always loved Notre Dame, and this was just an incredible experience for her and her choir to be singing there. So I was very, very excited to be there for it. And it was incredibly moving. The acoustics were superb. The cathedral was absolutely radiant. And, you know, Ava and I were both separately moved to tears during the concert. And then, you know, to have this happen last night was just, I mean, we were crying for a different reason. It was just heartbreaking.
It's extraordinary. I mean, your daughter's Santa Monica High School Choir would have to be one of the last outside groups, presumably, to perform in the cathedral.
Yes, that's right. I believe that they were one of the very last groups. I don't even think there were any groups that performed on Sunday. I walked by Notre Dame because it was Palm Sunday, and the bells were chiming, and it was incredibly beautiful. It was like a crystal clear, perfect sky, beautiful, beautiful day. And there were services all day there, so I don't think there were any concerts. And so the Santa Monica Choir was, in fact, one of the very last groups. It was Friday at 11 a.m., and it was just an incredible experience.
Now, your daughter, Ava, who's one of the performers, is there. If you don't mind putting her on, I just want to ask her a quick question.
Hi,
Ava.
This is Ava.
Hi, congratulations on your performance on Friday. The choir sound absolutely beautiful, but you have to be, I would think, a little bit in shock over what happened. Share with us what that was like for you.
Yeah, I think my mom pretty much summed it up perfectly. The experience in Notre Dame was like no other. I was just so moved because I think the thing about music is you can reach anyone. It doesn't matter what language you speak. Music is so powerful, and getting to perform in a cathedral like that is so moving. And then to see it all be taken away in such a fast amount of time, it was just, yeah, shocking and heart-wrenching.
Well, and
Larry,
yes, Lael, yeah.
I'm just going to say that Ava said goodbye to her choir yesterday. They got on a plane yesterday morning, left for the airport about 6:30, and they didn't know what happened until their plane landed about 6 o'clock California time, I think. And it was just shocking to them. We were just among the last ones here because we decided to stay a few extra days. And so to see this happen was just surreal. just impossible.
Have you and Ava, have you talked with any of the parents or the students in the Santa Monica High School choir who came back to Southern California?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That was the first thing that I did when I found out about it. And I've talked to most of them. We've been sending messages about it. And I think we were all just really, really shocked and taken aback. But I'm glad we all have each other.
All right. Mm-hmm. I'm going to let you both go. But thank you so much for taking this time, for sharing what I know is a deeply emotional experience, the high of the performance there Friday and how wonderful the Santa Monica High School choir sounded, and then the devastation of yesterday's fire doing such extensive damage to the cathedral. Thank you both very much.
Yeah.
That's
Larry.
Thank you. Leah Lowenstein, KPCC Film Week critic there in Paris, with her daughter Ava, a member of the Santa Monica High School choir, performing in beautiful Notre Dame Cathedral, which suffered such extensive damage. The outer walls are still there, although we've had French officials say that there is concern about the stability of the walls. The roof is gone. 800-year-old beams in that ceiling. Those trees from which they got the lumber for the ceiling aren't even there in France anymore. And of course, that central spire, which collapsed while we were on the air yesterday during Air Talk. Joining us now is Eleanor Beardsley, NPR correspondent based in Paris. She was with us yesterday. She was in the cab just trying to get to Notre Dame to cover it. Eleanor, thank you for being with us. What a remarkable 24 hours since this fire started. Share with us just the pall that there has to be over the city.
Oh, totally. I mean, I finally did get the heat tonight, and I just watched the cathedral burn for hours, along with thousands of people. Just, it was almost silence, and then people started praying and singing hymns and kneeling and just staring. And when people were filled with pain, but also just horror, panic, that the flames would not stop. So it was really bad. And then today, I went out, you know, early this morning, and people were out again. They wanted to see their Notre Dame Cathedral in the daylight to see what the damage was. And, you know, actually from the outside, the structure has been saved. You can see charring, you know, charred stone out of one of the stained glass windows, but the bell towers in the front are still there. Of course, that beautiful spire, which weighed 250 tons, by the way, is gone. But, you know, it doesn't look so bad, but there was a picture released by the government today of the inside, and it's just a gaping hole in the ceiling, so it's pretty bad.
Well, and I think that the thing that's so difficult to fully get one's head around is the restoration and reconstruction. We're looking at decades of work, one would think, to put this cathedral back together again. It's kind of hard to conceive the amount of time.
Well, it's true. But you know what's interesting is there's this whole cadre of people in France who are it's a whole professional class, and it's a very exclusive group of people who actually have these skills of stone cutting and, you know, glass, you know, stained glass making, these old skills. And I think these people are going to be called upon. But another thing is, I was listening to the news today, and this cathedral is so fully documented. What is the word I'm looking for? You know, they've got the whole, they have so many modern techniques now to rebuild things. Like, they're totally rebuilding these Syrian ruins, you know, down to the absolute minute detail. So Notre Dame is just completely charted, by computers inside and out. So I think it's going to probably, I'm just guessing, go faster than people think, because they have so many, you know, means at their disposal to build things today than they, of course, did 800 years ago.
Very, very good point. I know they're looking at transferring some of the surviving works of art, the paintings, to the Louvre, and a lot of restoration. I've seen concern about smoke damage, but are they concerned some of those paintings could have been badly damaged by the water from the hoses that were, you know, water put on the fire?
They are, and you know what? The church, for the next 48 hours, the cathedral, they're doing a stability check. They found some weak points under the transept, under some of the vaulted ceiling, the vault, they're calling it. And for 48 hours, they're going to be checking that, you know, the firefighters. And they're even evacuating a building behind the North Transept, a residential building. And so no one's allowed in until this is done. And this is going to be in about 2 days' time. So, you know, there's a 16th century organ in there that's said to be a jewel. They think it survived. It didn't go up in smoke, but they don't know what the damage could be. They're going to go in 2 days and you know, be able to get a lot of this artwork and the organ. But we won't. We'll have to wait a couple of days to see.
Having visited Notre Dame, I noticed the organ, but I didn't realize there were around 8,000 pipes. I mean, the size of that organ's extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. These are just, you know, 16th century. Can you imagine the 1500s that thing was built? It is unimaginable. I mean, America wasn't even a country, of course, far from it. So,
Eleanor, has there been a discussion to this point about the firefighter response? Because, you know, as we were talking yesterday when you were getting to the scene, I was not seeing on video water actually getting onto that fire for a considerable period of time. You know, I know it's on an island in the river. It's tough to get to. It's extremely high. But has there been talk about whether there was a plan that was not being carried out initially as they had planned?
I haven't heard that yet. What we have heard actually is that when those timbers went up, and I heard you saying earlier, you know, that ceiling, which is apparently 100 yards of old 800-year-old timber, that just went up. Like, and the firefighters had to make a decision at that point. Do we try to save the facade, the bell towers, and the structure, or do we try to put out the ceiling? And they could not put out the roof. It was just so combustible. So they did make that decision, and they decided to try to save artworks and save the edifice. And that's what they did. And we've just found out tonight by the Deputy Interior Minister, who said that a handful of firefighters went into the bell towers inside the cathedral, risking their lives, and fought the fire from within, and that actually saved it. And he said, we found out this morning that we may have come, you know, from anywhere from half an hour to 15 minutes of almost losing the cathedral. That's how close
Wow.
it came.
And we wouldn't have seen that on television, if they're fighting from the inside like that.
You know, there were many problems. The winds were very high yesterday. I remember being high yesterday thinking that before this even started. And then their ladders weren't high enough, and you can't drop water on it. It'll, you know, it's too heavy. It'll damage the structure. So there were many problems, and they just had to pick their battle.
Yeah, I can't imagine how difficult that was for them to try and figure out what's our highest priority and what do we do, and what degree of risk do you take on to try and move out the relics, the artwork, when people's lives could be in jeopardy while doing that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. We're talking with Eleanor Beardsley, NPR correspondent, who's based in Paris, sharing with us about the remarkable and such sad events of yesterday with Notre Dame Cathedral. What about the relics? Were they able to save most of those, Eleanor?
Well, there was some relics in the very top of the spire, some relics that were to protect the people of Paris, and so those went down. They did save Saint-Louis, his tunic, and they saved a crown of thorns that was said to belong to Saint-Denis. So these are the things they're talking about, but they were able to save probably many things. But like I said, I don't think we're going to have a full idea of what's been saved and what's been lost until a couple days, but they have been able to save quite a few things.
And that crown of thorns, which I guess considered the most sacred of the relics at Notre Dame, apparently they were able to get that out fairly quickly.
Absolutely, yes.
So that was purported to have been what Christ wore at the crucifixion. So that was saved. And then I guess the tunic of Saint-Louis, which is from the 13th century, the culture minister said that. So I guess we'll just have to see what was lost, what of the artwork can be restored that might have damage. I'm assuming it's going to take weeks to catalog all this and figure it out. Eleanor, again, when did they think they're going to be able to get into the structure and to really dig into this?
They said around 48 hours. from a couple hours ago. So what's today, Tuesday? We're looking at Thursday afternoon at the earliest.
Okay. I'll let you go, and thank you. We'll look forward to your reporting on All Things Considered later today. Thank you, Eleanor.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye, Eleanor Beardsley in Paris, where a city in mourning. But of course, it's not just Parisians, it's a nation, and it's people around the world who know the extraordinary beauty and the remarkable history of Notre Dame Cathedral. Joining us, BBC reporter based in Paris, Ben Tavener. Ben, thank you for being with us. And what are some of the conversations you've had with Parisians in the past 24 hours?
So we arrived this morning from London just as the last flames were being put out, and some of those 500 firefighters were starting to withdraw. But over the course of the day, we've seen a number of people up and around on the structure of the cathedral. There are people that right now. I'm on the south bank of the River Seine, just near overlooking the South Rose window, which appears to be intact. But as we got here this morning, there weren't that many people down here on the embankment, more press than anything. But as the day has worn on and as the working day has come to an end, there has just been an absolute torrent of people coming down here and just paying respects. You see it in different ways. You see some people putting photos up on their favorite social media site. Or you see somebody has just finished playing next to me. A young lady came down here and just from nowhere began playing the violin in front of everybody. We've heard numerous reports of from last night when people just broke spontaneously into singing Ave Maria. So there are lots of different ways that people are coming down here and sort of expressing their sadness. And that is the overwhelming sentiment here, disbelief and sadness. I mean, we have started to ask people as well, looking, you know, to whether we can start to point fingers at what went wrong here. But really, it is too soon. We're just over 24 hours since that fire started. And really, there just is this sense of disbelief and sadness.
We're talking with the BBC's Ben Tavener. He's in Paris to cover the aftermath of the 12-hour-plus long fire at Notre Dame Cathedral. If you'd like to share your experience of Notre Dame, its significance to you, maybe you're from Paris, living here in Southern California or visiting Southern California from Paris, we're at 866-893-KPECC. You can also comment on the Air Talk page, KPCC.org. Bill in the San Gabriel Valley writes on the page, what makes this especially sad is how iconic Notre Dame is in symbolizing Paris along with the Eiffel Tower. There are few structures in the world that represent a city or a country like the Sydney Opera House, the Houses of Parliament, and the clock tower, Big Ben. As I considered this last night, there are few in the U.S. Outside of the Hollywood sign, I couldn't come up with anything for Los Angeles, maybe sports venues. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. There are three famed rose windows, stained glass windows, that date to the 13th century. And Ben, have you been able to find out anything about the state of those stained glass windows?
I'm looking at the southern window right now, and you can see how close, perilously close, it got to being destroyed because the outcut of masonry above it is charred to the hilt with black soot. We've seen cranes coming in around the other side, the north window, which we believe is very badly damaged, and it appears that some of the statues and the gargoyles and the chimera that decorate and adorn the cathedral may be starting to be taken off by some of those cranes. Because, as we know, the restoration work was already happening at this cathedral. In fact, right in the middle, around where the spire fell yesterday, those scaffolding is still standing in place. The only difference is there is now a triangle wedge shape in that scaffolding where the wood and lead slating of the roof, which has collapsed in its entirety, once stood. As we know, the temperatures inside that cathedral we were hearing today from firefighters got up to around 800 Celsius or 1500 Fahrenheit. And, you know, for a fire that took, as you say, over 12 hours to be extinguished, up to 15 hours by some reports, then that really is a worry. And as Eleanor was saying, that the public prosecutor here is working with the police and the fire brigade to just make sure that the structural integrity of the building is intact. The first 48 hours will be going absolutely to that. We do know, though, that the public prosecutor has started its investigation. It's put some 50 experts onto that. And the people that were working on those restorative works that that we can see were taking place in the cathedral by this scaffolding that's on it, are starting to take statements from people. But at the moment, that's kind of the extent of it. And, you know, asking people here who they think could possibly to blame, they all really just saying to me that they pray this is an accident, because all of the conspiracy theories that you may or may not have seen on social media just don't bear fruit for them. They just really hope that this was an accident.
Marcy in Beverly Hills. Marcy, I understand you have an apartment in Paris. You visit regularly. Share with us your thoughts about yesterday's fire.
I do, and I've spent almost every evening there walking to Notre Dame and just looking at its beauty in the evening. And it was absolutely horrifying yesterday to watch. It was like losing a family relative or a family member to watch that burn. And I was in touch with my friends in Paris, and they felt the same way. They were just stunned. They couldn't move. It's just such a loss.
Yeah, it's remarkable how a structure like that symbolizes so much. I mean, the walk to Notre Dame that you take every night, the knowing the centuries that it's been there, the place that it holds, it's and let alone its religious significance. There's that, and then all this additional as well. Marcy, I appreciate your call. Thank you so much. Elizabeth in West Hills, you have a memory of Notre Dame you'd like to share.
I arrived in Paris with a friend I was traveling with on 9/11. It was a devastating experience. We saw the second plane crash into the World Trade Center at our hotel. And 2 days later, there was a service for the Americans at Notre Dame. It was so beautiful and so moving. The French people were very caring and loving and supportive of us. And it meant a lot to us to be in Notre Dame, literally cheek to jowl packed, every space taken for that service. It was beautiful.
Elizabeth, that's a wonderful memory to share. Thank you. We appreciate it very much. Elizabeth in West Hills. And along the theme that she's raising of that international support, Ben Tavener of the BBC, I've been reading about multiple European countries, other countries beyond Europe, offering support and expertise. Can you give us a little bit of a sense of that kind of immediate offer of help?
Well, it started really from when President Emmanuel Macron came to the scene last night. He came and was absolutely silent. But fairly soon after that, conversation started about how on earth the massive restorative work was going to take place. To this moment, the last thing I read was that $700 million has been pledged by various companies, many of them luxury French companies such as LVMH and the group behind Yves Saint Laurent and Gucci. But as you say, it's not just those big private firms that are picking up the mantle and sort of putting their support behind the idea of restoring the cathedral. Donald Tusk, the president of the European Council, has also called on EU members to chip in, if you like, and to offer their support to their European ally. And as a Brit myself, we do have something that looks something like the Notre Dame, of course, next to the Houses of Parliament and Big Ben, which is Westminster Abbey. The sort of double tower facade on that was only added in the last couple of centuries, but there certainly is some sort of parallel that you can see there. And Westminster Abbey has offered its condolences as of last night.
Ben, thank you so much. Appreciate your talking with us about the conversations you've had, the what you've been seeing there just across the river from Notre Dame, and describing what the cathedral looks like, what's going on there today. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Ben Taverner, BBC reporter in Paris. Emily in Pomona said, I'm very fortunate that I visited Paris on multiple occasions. And though I'm not Catholic, Notre Dame transcends religion. It's a cultural treasure, and people should go see it even after the damage from the fire. That's Emily in Pomona. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. And we're going to take you into our break with the sound of Parisians on the street within eyesight of Notre Dame Cathedral as they worship together and pay tribute to their beloved cultural landmark. Apparently, Americans are getting it on a lot less than in the past. That's according to results from the ongoing General Social Survey, which has provided so much fascinating information about American attitudes and behavior. It was about 3 weeks ago we talked about the survey's finding that fewer young Americans were in romantic relationships than previous generations. But now we turn our attention to sex. And in fact, among younger Americans, the percent who are having sex is down, particularly among young men. With us is Washington Post data reporter Christopher Ingram. Christopher, great to have you with us again.
Hey, thanks so much. Happy to be here.
So you've taken a look at the numbers here, and what's the percentage of young people who aren't having sex?
Well, the percentage of people aged 18 to 29 who aren't having sex has really skyrocketed just in the past decade. Back in 2008, just about 9% of that age group weren't having sex. Fast forward to 2018, and the survey showed that 23% of that age group, that's more than a doubling in the rise of celibacy among that age group in less than a decade. And the interesting thing about these surveys is these numbers don't tend to change a whole lot over time. So when you see a big jump like that, it really means there's something strange and interesting happening there.
And one of the issues could be that people are delaying marriage, but you know, it's been a long time since Americans, the majority, you know, waited till marriage to have sex. So how much of marriage do you think might be a factor here in the delay versus people are doing other things than having sex?
Yeah, well, marriage is absolutely a factor. You know, the kind of the old stereotype, the punchline you often hear about marriage is that people stop having sex when they have marriage. But when you look at the data, that's actually not true at all. Married people actually have a lot more sex on average than unmarried people. And it's just, you know, you've got somebody there. You've got somebody that you can do that with. And so the fact that marriage is coming later and later in life, that's naturally going to cause some of that shift you see among young people. But, you know, researchers I've spoken to say there's a lot of other things going on, too. You know, one of them told me is that, you know, there are just a whole lot more things to do at 10 o'clock at night than there were 20 or 30 years ago. You've got online videos, you've got social media, video games. So, you know, after lights go out at 10 o'clock, there's still a lot more things to do than there used to be. So a lot of people do think that electronics, technology are playing a significant role here.
I also wonder whether the fact that, it's my understanding, younger Americans drink less than
previous generations. You know, alcohol and sex often go together behaviorally. I was wondering if that might be a factor, that there's a higher degree of sobriety among young people. Also, there is a significant gender difference here. To what do you attribute the fact that more young men than young women are celibate?
Yeah, and that's kind of another thing that goes against stereotypes, right? You think of young men as being these partiers and, you know, boasting and having and boasting about their sexual exploits. But what we've seen, again, in the past 10 years is this kind of gap in the data opening up between young men and young women, where young men are now much more likely to say that they are not having sex than young women are. And there's a lot of discussion around why this might be. Some of it may boil down to economic factors. We know that young men are not in the labor force the way that they used to be, and that affects all sorts of things like relationships and family formation. We also know that young men are more likely to live at home with their parents than young women. And, of course, that presents obvious difficulties to bringing home a romantic partner for the evening. I don't think we fully understand what's going on with those numbers, but there's definitely something interesting going on there. A lot of people positing a lot of different ideas for what it could be.
Joaquin in South Los Angeles writes on the page, the rise of casual sex has increased sexual inequality. More men have multiple partners and more men have zero partners. Bernie, why won't you address sex inequality? That's Joaquin in South Los Angeles. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org, or you can call us at 866-893-5722. What do you think is behind the decreasing percentage of young Americans who are having sex? 866-893-KPECC. We'll bring into our conversation University of Utah Professor Daniel L. Carlson, and we'll take your calls, hear what you have to say. We'll be back right after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. It's the gift that keeps on giving, at least for Air Talk segments. So happy to have the General Social Survey with us, which seemed to have surveyed Americans about virtually every conceivable topic. They do it every 2 years. And also a gift to us is Washington Post data reporter Christopher Ingram, because he's found all kinds of interesting ways of analyzing the numbers that are in the survey to give us a sense of where we are as a country. And as he just described, one of the biggest shifts we see in just over a decade is the decline in the percentage of young Americans from 18 to 29 who are celibate. We're talking about the reasons behind this. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Also with us is Daniel L. Carlson, Assistant Professor of Family and Consumer Studies at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. Professor Carlson, welcome.
Thank you.
Your thoughts about this, and does it surprise you that the shift is so dramatic in just 10 years?
I think, you know, one thing about the General Social Survey is that, you know, it is a wonderful repeated cross-section that allows us to track trends in U.S. society over time. But it is, you know, a smaller survey, only, you know, samples, maybe 1,500 folks any given year. And so for overall trends, it's great. But when we start getting into subsamples, you know, we need to be a little cautious with the data. So, you know, if there's only 1,500 folks and we, you know, limit that to like young adults, and then we break that down by gender, you know, we're talking about maybe 100 people. And so there's going to be a lot of volatility, you know, in these estimates, you know, and so the trends nevertheless do seem to suggest a decline in sexual frequency. And I think, you know, Christopher hits on all the, you know, factors that really are, matter here, right? The delay of marriage, you know, young men's precarious attachment to the labor force, things like this. And we all know that those things are predictive of sex. And so, you know, these trends are really consistent with what's going on, you know, socially in the U.S.
Let's take a call from Barry in Culver City. Barry, welcome to Air Talk. Your thoughts about the survey?
Thanks. I'm glad you guys brought up methodology. I just wanted to sort of flip the whole scenario here. Because these are self-report measures, and self-report about sexual activity particularly is always very inconsistent and murky. So maybe it's not that sex has changed at all, but maybe as we move towards a more awakened, enlightened society, people are exaggerating less. Maybe this is how much sex we've always had, and people are just being more honest as we move through time and not feeling the need to brag or to pump themselves up from a sexual way. Drinking behavior drop may be part of that as well. It's just my point really is that you have to be so careful when you make these like really pretty wild conjectures based on what people say that they're doing. So sexual activity hasn't dropped. The amount of sex that people are reporting that they are having has dropped.
But are you skeptical that the amount of sex engaged in by young people has dropped? Because this isn't the only place that I've seen data that reflect that. But you think that may just all be a fact of greater honesty?
I think it may be. I know that the pressure when I'm 50, so I know the pressure when I was a young man to bluff one's sexual prowess. I think you can easily make the argument that that is lesser. I hope it is. As we become, you know, more sensitive towards gender issues and sexual issues, I'm just saying it's an equally logical explanation for the data.
Yeah.
Is that what you're getting is a more accurate reflection of how much sex people have.
I appreciate it, Barry. Thanks so much for raising that issue. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Professor Carlson, I also wonder if, you know, changes in attitudes about sexually transmitted infections factors in. I think, you know, among older Americans, obviously, no one wanted to get some sort of a sexually transmitted infection. But my sense is young people are particularly preoccupied with that fear. Do you think that that's been an inhibiting factor?
You raised the point earlier about, just generally, this younger generation, just less risk. They're more risk adverse, right? They don't drink as much. They don't do drugs to the same degree. They were, exhibiting almost like the elimination of smoking. Of course, we've seen vaping increase. If we think about this in terms of like, why do we care, right? It seems that this younger generation is doing exactly what we've always argued that they should be doing, right? Which is, don't have sex outside of marriage because, you're at risk for sexually transmitted diseases, or you're at risk for teen pregnancy or pregnancy at young ages before you have a job, before you finish school. And it seems that, they've taken all that that message to heart, right? And so some have made the argument that declining sex it matters here because sex is lead to, it's associated with happiness. People who have more sex are happier. But I think we need to take a step back and ask ourselves, why exactly are we so interested in this trend and why does it resonate so strongly with us?
Sheila in Santa Monica wondering if the availability of online pornography is having an effect. Someone else asking about masturbation. So the question would be, whether there are just fewer people having a partner for sex. And we had another listener ask about, online sexual relationships. Beverly in Pacific Palisades wondering about if, so some of these aspects of digital life, digital sex life, if you will, Professor Carlson, you think that could be?
So Gene Twenge, who was mentioned earlier, he did analysis using the 2016 GSS and tracking trends, and they looked at pornography usage, and they actually found that the sexual frequency really seems to be kind of unrelated to pornographic use, and if anything, it's those who don't watch pornography who seem to exhibit a decline in sexual frequency. I mean, I think the natural tendency is that, these things are replacing, right, the real life interaction, and people are going solo, so to speak, or they're using these, internet to supplement for their sex lives. But we don't really seem to see that.
All right. Let's see. Random Asian man writes on the Air Talk page. Funny handle. On dating apps, average or below average looking men are dismissed almost instantaneously, while above average looking men would instantly get connected to women. Therefore, we can see a trend with fewer men having dates slash sex. Only the above average looking men would be able to have sex. That's Random Asian man writing on the Air Talk page. KPCC.org. You're not random to us. Cesar writes on the page, I'm a 28-year-old millennial. Us millennials were told by baby boomers and Gen Xers who raised us to focus on yourself, focus on school, on your jobs. We were told not to get involved in relationships nor to derive happiness to derive happiness from our careers. It's rather funny. For years, my parents drilled that into my head, and I held out, instead going for more casual, short-term arrangements with members of the opposite sex. After I turned 26, my parents started sounding the alarms. They started moving from focus on school, focus on yourself, to you just wasted your prime. Now I guess I'm too old and will die single and alone. Cesar, say it ain't so. 866-893-KPECC. Or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Shira in Los Feliz says sex has become less of a conquest, also less of a requirement for status. Let's talk with Adrian in West Hollywood. You're on Air Talk.
Hi. At least being a millennial myself and a lot of my friends have had this experience, but I feel like we're a lot more stressed than previous generations. We're working a lot more. We're having problems with housing, and I think especially with women, stress decreases your sex drive, and I was wondering if that's something that has been taken into consideration with these types of studies.
Professor Carlson?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, the research that we've conducted looking at couples' sexual frequency, at least with respect to stress, you know, we don't measure stress specifically, but I will say that, you know, couples who tend to share the load with each other, share domestic labor, share breadwinning, we've actually seen sexual frequency increase with them. And it's couples who do things in a conventional way or, you know, kind of flip the script and have men doing the majority of housework and the female partner's the breadwinner, who seem to see the most dramatic decline in sexual frequency. And again, this is among couples. And so we wondered, like, why that was. And it seems to really kind of boil down to just unhappiness with their arrangements, feeling that their arrangements are less fair, feeling stuck in their arrangements. And so speaking to this notion of you know, millennials, you know, they shoulder a lot of student loan debt. The job market is tight for them. You know, and so, yes, I think that stress certainly plays a role here and is certainly, you know, impacts, you know, sex drive.
All right. All kinds of good questions coming in from our listeners. We'll continue our conversation with University of Utah Professor Daniel Carlson and Washington Post data reporter Christopher Ingram talking about the general social survey showing a dramatic decline over the past 10 years in the amount of sex that young Americans are engaging in between 18 and 29 years of age. We'll continue in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC, the General Social Survey, and numbers crunched by the Washington Post's Christopher Ingram show a decline in sexual activity among younger Americans. We're musing on the reasons why here. Christopher, we had a caller several minutes ago who brought up the point that this could really be about a more honest reporting of Americans, that in the past 10 years, men feel less of a need to prop themselves up egotistically with claiming sexual activity they weren't engaged in, that women are more honest about it as it's less stigmatized for women to be sexually active. Do you think that could be what we're seeing?
It certainly could be. It certainly could have a role to play. I would push back against that just a little bit in that, you know, it's not just this survey, but we've seen so much other research from folks like Dr. Carlson and others who just looking at different aspects of this and finding, you know, different kind of explanations and different confirmations of these trends from different surveys, different methods of analyzing things, that it's, you know, that these changes, I think they're definitely a real thing. I think certainly when you're dealing with survey research, you always have to be cognizant of self-report bias and that kind of thing. And it certainly, it, to the extent that, you know, it would reflect men becoming less boastful and more realistic, that would be a welcome change. But I do think there are also some really actually behavioral changes happening that are driving these numbers.
Professor Carlson, Gary in Bellflower said he'd read that there is an overall decline in men's testosterone levels. He's wondering if that's possibly that men's sex drives have declined.
That's news to me. But I'd have to look at the research. But you know, I think the point, you know, we're the other thing is we're still kind of really trying to wrap our minds around what's going on here, right? And there's a lot of plausible explanations. And I don't think that this is a situation in which we're going to find, you know, a magic bullet. I think that there's a lot of factors at play here. And I think that they're all contributing a piece. And that certainly could be.
Let's talk with Jackie in Riverside. You're on Air Talk.
Yes, I'm a teacher and I teach that age group. And what I'm finding is that they have no access really to develop personal, even conversation skills. Everything's done on the internet. You go to a restaurant or a Starbucks and everybody's on their phone. There's no personal interaction. And it's so much easier, especially if you're not an extrovert, to then revert to the internet and have all of your internet friends and internet relationships, and it's declining with personal relationships.
Hmm. Jackie, I appreciate the observation. Professor Carlson, University of Utah, what do you think?
I think that's an interesting, you know, supposition. I also think, though, that the internet facilitates sexual relationships, right? I mean, you have the rise of online dating. People are increasingly going towards this. You have websites like Tinder and Grindr, which also, you know, facilitate, you know, hooking up. So the role here of technology, I think, is certainly, you know, one that we're still trying to get, again, our heads around. And it seems obviously that the technology certainly plays a role socially these days. And what impact it has on sex, I think, you know, we still need to figure that out.
Christopher, also wanted to clarify, is this survey, does it include gay men and lesbians as well as heterosexuals?
It does, yes. And these numbers these numbers don't track partners. They ask actually separate questions about how many women or how many men have you slept with in the past year. But this basic question is just, you know, how many times in general have you had sex in the past year? So it would capture both straight, gay, and everyone in between.
Daniel in Alhambra, you're on Air Talk.
Hey, so I think that a big part of it, I really would like to see the research, like, controlling for fear or moderating for fear, but there is this idea of, I think, in the past 10 years, or what you see that change from before these 10 years that we talk about, is that this lack of, this like reduction of like a traditional way we view life, and it used to be like marriage was a very big part of life, and then we almost got into this warning zone of marriage where like a lot of people are getting divorced, and you hear about all these horror stories about marriage, whether on the media. So it's almost like this fear around marriage and getting into intimate relationships has really been on the rise, just as we've stepped away from that traditional way of living life. And so I would like to see, and I kind of want to define that as fear, although it can be defined as something else, and kind of see how that plays into the numbers. And maybe what we can see consistently across these participants are perhaps that we have that fear aspect.
I'm not sure I fully follow. Professor Carlson, you have thoughts about Daniel's point?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, there certainly has been, you know, a transition away from what you want to call traditional or conventional ways of doing things. You know, people are more likely to cohabit outside of marriage now than to go right into marriage. I will say that, you know, research suggests that we still partner up at about the same time and the same rate that we always have. We just have replaced cohabitation with marriage. And cohabitors, partly because they're younger, you know, have more sex than married couples. But I think what is driving these trends is really the sexual behavior of people who are not partnered. And so the question is, you know, have our attitudes changed about casual sex? Is this related to fear of sexually transmitted diseases? Have we, you know, kind of moved away from, you know, the sexual revolution and free love? I think really the focus should be on you know, the unpartnered as opposed to those who just aren't married.
Gentlemen, thank you. This has been very interesting, and I particularly appreciate our Air Talk listener comments and analysis on why the General Social Survey indicates that fewer young Americans are having sex. Christopher Ingram, guy who's crunched those numbers from the survey, data reporter at the Washington Post, who's been with us now a few times to talk about his reporting. Daniel L. Carlson, assistant professor of family and consumer studies at the University of Utah, where he conducts his research on American relationships. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Please don't go away. We got a lot more to come in the second hour. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Coming up later this hour, the ongoing struggle to California State University system to help students graduate within 4 years. It often takes 5-6 years for students to get through the system. Well, that's money that they're not making as a college graduate over those additional years. We're going to talk about ways the university system is going to try to speed up that process. But first, the LA City Council tomorrow takes up an ordinance which would put into effect a ban on landlords blanketly refusing to accept tenants who have Section 8 housing vouchers. Now, Section 8, of course, is the government assistance that some renters qualify for, usually after they wait on a list for a long period of time. It helps them with a voucher be able to afford to have an apartment in a high-rent area. Southern California certainly qualifies. But according to L.A. city officials, there are some landlords who just blanketly will not take Section 8 vouchers. This ordinance attempts to do away with that, and the state of California apparently considering legislation that would also enact something similar to what LA is considering. With us, executive director of the Housing Rights Center, a LA nonprofit, is Chantala Al-Mansour. Thank you very much for joining us on Air Talk.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
So how widespread, in your view, is the practice of landlords not wanting to take Section 8 tenants?
It's more the standard than the exception. If you were to look at any Craigslist ad or any rental ad or even old newspapers and so forth, you'll see that most apartment listings will say no Section 8, no Section 8 accepted.
All right. And at this point, there's no law against that. Landlords are able to say that right up front and are not required to treat Section 8 residents the same as any other tenant.
That's correct. There is no law that would prohibit that type of discrimination against a Section 8 voucher holder because of their Section 8.
All right. And from in terms of the overall rent that goes to the tenant, to the landlord, is it the same for a Section 8 voucher resident as it is for a typical off-the-street renter?
Yeah, the landlord will still ask as the same amount that the landlord thinks that they are entitled to. The only difference is that under a Section 8 or federal program, there is government assistance that pays for a portion of that rent, and then the tenant's responsible for their portion of the rent.
Also with us, the executive director of the Apartment Association of Greater Los Angeles, which an organization advocating for property owners, Dan Uchelson. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Thank you, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
Though your response to the prevalence of this practice, how frequent are these bans on Section 8 tenants?
Well, I think these bans are slightly overblown. You know, the problem is that the whole system is broken, particularly within the city of Los Angeles. The LA Housing Authority is just a huge bureaucratic nightmare, and that's why most property owners are reluctant to deal with it. If you're a small mom and pop owner like I am, My wife and I own a four-unit building. I just don't have time. I have a full-time job. I don't have time to deal with the entire bureaucracy that the LA Housing Authority throws at property owners like me. Now, if you're working with a city like Glendale or Santa Monica or Long Beach, you know, these cities have a lot more services they provide to property owners, and they help owners through the process. I mean, why not have government backing your rental payments? But within the city of LA Housing Authority, it could take you 3 or 4 months to get your renter in because you may have not prepared all the paperwork correctly. They tend to lose some of the paperwork. They haven't modernized their process. They don't accept copies or faxes or emails or scans. You actually have to mail in original signed documents, or you have to drop them off in person. And, you know, many of our members have experienced that when they've mailed in these documents, you know, the LA Housing Authority tends to lose them, and you have to start the process over again from the very beginning.
Is this on a per tenant basis? There's no sort of blanket Section 8 qualification that you as the landlord can take Section 8 tenants?
No, it's on a per unit basis. And each unit requires a separate inspection. If you have more than one Section 8 unit at your building, the inspectors will invariably come out on different days. So you have to take time off of work to be there at separate times and on separate days. It's just a huge hassle. And like I said, in other cities who've got the process down and who actually help property owners are willing to adopt it and willing to deal with Section 8 renters. But with the LA Housing Authority, it's a completely different story. I've heard nightmares of owners having to keep their units vacant for 3 or 4 months to just get that initial inspection. And then the inspectors will come out and they will not approve the unit because a light switch isn't working or a wall outlet isn't working.
Where in other cities that wouldn't be a deal breaker?
In Long Beach, they'll allow the renter to move in before they do the inspection, before even the paperwork's completed. But not only in LA is it bad that the owner doesn't get rent for all this time while they're waiting through all these delays and red tape, but the poor veteran or the poor family that is in need of housing is on the street still. It's a huge issue.
I'd love to hear from listeners. If you are a landlord or a Section 8 voucher recipient, share with us your thoughts about this proposed Los Angeles City ordinance, which would keep landlords from having a blanket ban on accepting Section 8 housing vouchers for their units. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Again, Executive Director, Housing Rights Center in Los Angeles, Chancela Al-Mansour. Your response to what Mr. Yukelson was saying about the bureaucracy with the city of L.A., how difficult they make it for landlords.
Well, that did happen in terms of there being a delay for some good landlords. But the norm, what happened most of the time in Los Angeles, is only because there was no prohibition against discrimination against Section 8, only landlords who would take Section 8 were ones who had substandard housing oftentimes. And so nobody wants the government to pay rent to a landlord where there are substandard conditions. And so, yes, the housing authority would hold landlords up to a higher standard than what's normally required under normal city code enforcement oftentimes. And so if landlords just kept their properties up and so forth, that would often help to expedite the process so that inspectors don't have to come back several times. And hopefully that's what this ordinance, by requiring landlords to not deny a Section 8 applicant based on their Section 8 status, that would help also bring more units into better standard, better habitable conditions, so that there isn't this issue of whether or not the government is subsidizing substandard conditions.
Chancellor,
the Housing Authority is going to, did say, is going to address many of those concerns and is going to expedite the process.
Chancellor, this ordinance, I understand, would do away with a blanket ban on Section 8 rentals by a landlord. But could landlords still do a case-by-case refusal to rent to Section 8 voucher holders?
Yes, yes. This law does not prohibit landlords from screening tenants. It just says that they have to abide by the law and cannot single out Section 8 voucher holders and say that they're not going to rent to them because they have a Section 8 voucher.
So I had a landlord who called in, spoke with one of our producers, didn't want to share his name, says, is there any policy that would make Section 8 come with a mandate ensuring tenants maintain their apartments? I've rented to two people who were Section 8 tenants. I understand they need a place to live, but they didn't take care of the house that I rented to them. That was very frustrating to me. Go back to Dan Uchelson. Dan, is that a complaint that you hear from landlords, that they feel as though, on average, Section 8 tenants are tougher to deal with in terms of property maintenance?
No, it's really the system. It's really the broken system that's the issue. The one thing the LA Housing Authority does force upon owners is that every year the renters are supposed to fill out forms to become recertified, and if they don't do it, they make the owner become the hammer. And so the owner does not get paid if the renter doesn't submit the forms, and then the owner is forced to start an eviction process to try to get the renter to put those forms in. It's just a huge administrative nightmare to deal with the LA Housing Authority.
And again, that requirement's in LA only to have that renter form?
Yes. You know, other smaller cities seem to do a much better job at managing the program.
Now, Santa Monica's already passed an ordinance like this.
Yes, that's
correct. How is that playing out there?
Well, you know, because of the services Santa Monica offers, you know, owners are willing to volunteer for it. And L.A. ought to look to, you know, force the L.A. Housing Authority to clean up its act and, you know, keep it as a voluntary program. And owners would embrace it far more than they do today.
We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Tracy in Hollywood says discriminating on the basis of the source of income seems like any other source of any other form of discrimination. I don't think that should be legal, she says. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let's see. Norman Lakewood says, having dealt with my mother's house in L.A. compared to renting our house in Lakewood, I can attest to Los Angeles being way too complicated with its regulations. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Dan, are there certain advantages to renting to Section 8 applicants? I mean, the consistency of having the voucher that's available to the person?
Well, part of it is you have Uncle Sam backing up your rent. And there truly are a lot of owners that want to help out veterans and people in need. And they're, you know, willing to participate, but they can't participate if they have to leave their units vacant, can't receive rent for several months, have to deal with a lot of red tape and inspections. It's just a huge burden, particularly for smaller owners.
Rashid in Highland Park says, I understand both landlords and tenants on this. I'm a veteran and I've been in Section 8 housing. I get that the government bureaucracy can be frustrating, but landlords have a stigma against Section 8. We're not all drug addicts. Some of us just fell into a bad situation. I think the stigma is a bigger deal than the bureaucracy blocking Section 8 housing. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Chancellor Al-Mansour of Housing Rights Center in Los Angeles, how much of a stigma do you think there is against Section 8 tenants?
Well, I actually was pleased to hear what the apartment owner's representative just said when he said it's not the tenants. That in his view, it's the administrative headache of it. And that's exactly what we see as well at the Housing Rights Center. A Section 8 tenant has been on a waiting list, if they were lucky enough to get on one, for over 8 to almost 10 years. And they get vetted constantly, down to their credit reports, their criminal background, and so forth. And it's so much so, to some degree, we fair housing advocates think that it's too much and that it may have a disparate impact upon them, some of this vetting process. But a Section 8 tenant is probably going to be a better tenant than a tenant who doesn't have a government subsidy because it's worth so much to them and because it will be taken away from them if they are found to have committed fraud or not turned in paperwork on time, missed an appointment, or so forth.
Tony in downtown Los Angeles, you're on Air Talk.
Hey, yes, man. I'm a landlord. I own 15 units, and I can tell you it is difficult renting the Section 8 because, first of all, like the other lady said, they don't get kicked off. I mean, they will get kicked off if they do something wrong. They have never got kicked out of Section 8. Section 8 inspectors, they'll come up to you and they'll say, oh, you know, I can stick my fingernail underneath of this little paint chip right here. You got to paint the whole place inside and out. And if it doesn't pass, which it normally doesn't, they'll put you in abatement and they cut your check off. So now you're not getting any Section 8 money. And you got to go ahead and make all those repairs yourself while you're making the mortgage and take time off of work. And you can't evict a Section 8 tenant because when you go to court downtown, you go into a special court. They go hear what the tenant has to say, you sit outside the room, and they come out there and they tell you what they're going to do. And you have to, with Section 8, they're going to tell you how much money they're going to give you. It's difficult.
Tony, I appreciate the call. Chancellor Al-Mansour, your response to what Tony's describing.
Yeah, just I have many responses, but first of all, there is no special court for Section 8 tenants if they have to face eviction. There's only one court, so forth, that all unlawful detainers and other type municipal court proceedings are held. So they're not given special consideration at all. It is true that an owner does have to have a good cause reason to evict to terminate a Section 8 tenancy. Or to terminate their Section 8 contract. But the good cause means that the owner has to have a reason. The tenant had to have done something wrong. Or the owner has to have a good reason, such as maybe having to take the unit off the market or having to move in themselves. But there's no special requirement for Section 8 tenants. And in Los Angeles, those units that have rent stabilized units, it's the same thing as well, is that an owner has to have a good cause reason in order to terminate their tenancy, in order to evict them.
Let's talk with Ray in Atwater Village. Ray, I understand you're a compliance inspector?
Yes, not for the city of Los Angeles, so just for a local municipality.
Yeah, share with us what you see in terms of renting to Section 8 recipients.
Well, my experience, over 20 years experience, I've done Section 8 housing inspections, habitability inspections, and where I work at least, I found that the voucher holders, the tenants, are, number one, very grateful for the voucher, and in my experience here, they do maintain their units very well. Basically, I think in not wanting to lose a voucher or cause any issues, you know, with their voucher. So my experience, anecdotally or not, is that they do maintain their units in very good condition. And for the most part, owners are very cooperative. And the inspections that we've done where I work are not as onerous as some, you know, other landlords have been describing, I believe. Like, for example, the gentleman who talked about, you know, the peeling paint and then you got to paint the whole building in and out. I just don't think that's true, and that's not a requirement for habitability standards under the federal guidelines for Section 8 housing.
All right, Ray, thanks very much. Dan Euclidson, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, the problem is with the inspections being done by the L.A. Housing Authority, it's done by an outside company, and they do get into minutiae like that. There's been owners that have been kicked out for staying on a wall in a garage or, in one case, a non-functioning wall outlet. The issue is that they don't distinguish between habitability and non-habitability issues. And they'll keep, you know, veterans and needy families on the streets while the owner has to go through these hoops to get the unit certified, where in Long Beach and Santa Monica, they can move in, or the renters can move in on day one without an inspection.
Sylvia in San Pedro says, I own an apartment complex. I have a Section 8 tenant, and that person's a hoarder. The apartment's full of junk, and then when the city comes to inspect, we have to help clean everything up at our own cost. That's Sylvia in San Pedro. A final comment from Chancellor Al-Mansour of Housing Rights Center in Los Angeles. This point, you think prospects for LA City Council passage of this are strong?
Yes, I do. I think it's been recognized that we are in a crisis right now when it comes to the displacement of renters, and also when it comes to our homelessness crisis as well. This is just one step in the right direction, along with other measures that people are considering, such as right to counsel and anti-tenant ordinance as well, anti-tenant harassment ordinance, as well, and the expansion of rent stabilized units throughout LA County. And also there's a state ordinance, a proposed bill as well. Senator Holly Mitchell
Council's SB 329, which would include a source of income protection to all Section 8 tenants throughout the state of California.
Chancela Al-Mansour, a Housing Rights Center nonprofit in L.A. She's executive director. Thank you for being with us. And Dan Uchelson, executive director of the Apartment Association of Greater L.A. Thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you.
We have Richard in West Hollywood said, I used to have Section 8 tenants, but when they changed the program 15 years ago, it made it untenable for me. It's much more work to rent to Section 8 residents. Used to be government guaranteed rent. Now not, just not worth it anymore for me. Share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. We'll be back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on AirTalk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. For a number of years, the California State University system has been challenged by getting the majority of its students graduating within 4 years. Now, there are many reasons for that, including heavily impacted courses, which make it difficult for students to get classes to graduate on time. Many CSU students are also working, sometimes even full-time, as they attend the four-year universities. And they're often coming from families where there's a need to provide financial support from those going to college as well. But CSU is trying to take on the challenge and find a way to boost the numbers. The graduation rate within 4 years at some of the campuses is below 20%, the highest in the whole system. Cal Poly at just over half of the students graduating within 4 years. Cal State Los Angeles has under 10% of its students graduating within 4 years. Joining us is the Assistant Vice Chancellor and Senior Strategist of the California State University System, James Miner. Sir, thank you very much for being with us. Share with us, first of all, what you see as the biggest challenge in getting students out within 4 years.
Well, thanks, Larry, and thanks for the conversation. I think there are two primary issues, and they sort of work together to compound this challenge of four-year graduation rate. But I want to make one acknowledgement. I think the average graduation rate for the CSU is about 4.7 years. And so we've taken a really hard look at the students who are staying just beyond the four-year mark. They would be captured in the six-year rate. So part of it is to make the college-going experience more responsive to the needs of the students we're now enrolling, which you mentioned, but also to help them participate more effectively and efficiently. But let me answer the question more directly. I think, as you noted, our idea of students being dropped off by both parents in the station wagon with everything they need for college is no longer the reality. And so one part of this equation is how institutions of higher education become more responsive to the current needs of students. And I think that has been the focus of the graduation initiative in the CSU. The second part of the equation is how to make students better informed about the choices they have about how to navigate colleges and universities, which tend to be very complex environments and that comes along with very complex choices. As you noted, a good number of our students are going to be the first in their family to ever step foot on a college campus, and will have to make a series of choices that will ultimately impact not only their time to degree, but whether or not they're successful at all at earning a college degree and walking across a commencement stage.
I also wonder about, is it emphasized to students that the more quickly they're able to get their degree, the bigger their overall income, because then they'll be employed as a college graduate. And I wonder sometimes, I understand the financial necessity in many cases to work while in school, that otherwise they couldn't go to school if they didn't work. But I wonder if students understand on the other side of it that getting out more quickly has a real financial impact.
Well, I think the answer is yes, but this is a outstanding question. One is about what's the capacity of institutions to provide the resources, the courses that are required for a student to graduate in 4 years. But let me just be careful. I mean, the idea, as you noted, Larry, is not every student today who arrives on a college campus even endeavors to graduate in 4 years. I think the goal here is to serve the students who endeavor to and who have the ability to graduate in 4 years. The idea that the institution shouldn't create obstacles or unnecessary roadblocks for those students. The idea that a student who endeavors to graduate in 5 years, it should not take her six. For a student who endeavors to graduate in 4 years, it should not take them five. But the idea of cost savings and earnings, for some of our students, that is very apparent, but others, it's not. I mean, imagine, again, the first in your family to ever set foot on a college campus. Many students we are learning are accepting admissions to campuses sight unseen. So, I mean, this is a very complicated issue, and what we want to do is make students smarter about their choices and make them smarter about the consequences of those choices in terms of their time to degree. Right now, what we're trying to help students understand is just staying one extra semester could cost them as much as an additional $13,000. And, you know, we're all aware of what that means in terms of foregone income in the workforce. But, you know, whether or not those choices are obvious to, you know, an 18 or 19 year old who's trying to figure out, you know, their first set of courses in college, the answer is likely not.
Yeah, and trying to figure out how to pay for books and all the other expenses associated. We're talking with James Miner, Assistant Vice Chancellor and Senior Strategist for the California State University System. He heads up the program Graduation Initiative 2025, which is designed to try and help students graduate more quickly once they come in as either a freshman student at a Cal State University or as a transfer from a community college, because there as well, you're seeing that the majority of students who enter as juniors are not graduating within 2 years. It's taking them typically longer, and they may also have been delayed in getting through the 2 years of the community college program. So by the time they're done with a CSU, if they're a transfer student, they may have been in school 6, 7 years, perhaps even longer if they were going to school part-time while going to a community college. A little bit later, we're going to take your calls. We'll open up the phones at 866-893-KPCC. I'd like to hear from you if you're an administrator, a professor, a student currently at a Cal State or at a Cal State in the past. What do you think would be a way that would be most helpful for students to be able to get the pace that they want and need to get through college in a way that's most financially and otherwise beneficial? James Miner, I'm also wondering about the demographics of the CSU. Highly diverse, of course, here in California. As you mentioned, so many students are first in their families to go to college or to get degrees. But what about the age demographic? Has that shifted?
Well, I think we have to be careful. And I think we have to be data informed in talking about who our students are. The idea that, you know, CSU students or students who are attending college and universities across the state of California are somehow overwhelmed by their life circumstances so much that they couldn't earn a college degree, I don't think is true for the majority of students who are attending college. The average age of the CSU student attending is a very what we would refer to as a traditionally aged student, less than 23 years old. So these are students, by and large, who are recently out of high school, who are attempting college for the first time. And I just think we have to be careful. The idea that, you know, students are too poor, too hungry, working too much to graduate in 4 years should not sort of be placed on them. I think it is up to the institutions, the university system, to figure out ways to more effectively serve students. And, you know, think about this. Sometimes that you, when we ask students in their orientation, when they walk through the door, how many of you expect to graduate in 4 years, the overwhelming majority of the hands go up. More than 80% of those students expect to graduate. Now the institutions have to figure out how to deliver, and that means the course availability, the requisite number of faculty teaching courses, and giving students good and timely advice so that they make the proper choices to accomplish their educational goals.
What percentage of your students live with their families and commute to the campuses?
The overwhelming majority, it's over 70% of students are non-residential, meaning that they don't live on a CSU campus, that they're living in communities, they're living with their families, and they're commuting to college campuses every day.
All right. And presumably, given the youth, as you're describing the college audience enrollees, the majority of those are probably living with their families, I would guess.
That's correct.
All right. James Miner, thank you so much for being with us to talk about the program Graduation Initiative 2025 for the CSU campuses. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Larry.
James Miner, Assistant Vice Chancellor, Senior Strategist, California State University System. Coming up, we'll talk with San Diego Union-Tribune reporter Gary Robbins, who's written about this effort of the Cal States to try and speed up the number of years it takes for a student to graduate, get it down to 4 years for the majority of students. We'll also take your calls. I'd love to hear from you if you're a recent Cal State graduate, a current Cal State student, faculty member, administrator in the CSUs. What do you think would make the biggest difference to allow students to get out more quickly with their degree? 866-893-KPCC. Back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurtis. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. We continue our conversation on the California State University system and its difficulty helping students graduate within 4 years. The challenge is coming from numerous areas, including the difficulty in students getting the classes they need in a timely manner. But I'd like to hear from you if you're a current or recent CSU student. If you're a faculty member or administrator, we're at 866-893-KPCC. San Diego Union-Tribune reporter Gary Robbins has just written about this in Cal State San Marcos, how it's trying to deal with this challenge. Gary, thank you for being with us.
Oh, it's good to be with you.
So how are they trying to deal with just, you know, having enough classes available for students so students don't have to wait forever to get them?
They're like a lot of schools right now, Larry. They're struggling to do that. Their enrollment has doubled in the last 15 years. There's a lot of growth in North Orange County and in parts of Southwest Riverside County and South Orange County. So there are more people. They want a CSU campus. They're flooding in to San Marcos, which is trying to offer enough units. And many of their students are going part-time instead of full-time. Now, as the gentleman before me said, they are trying to say, please try to go and take 15 units. They have these signs on campus where they say, you know, 12 equals 5 years, 15 equals 4 years. But Larry, there's a problem here. There's a conflicting message coming from the CSU system and from other universities. San Diego State University, for example, in news releases, boasted recently about its six-year rate, but it wants people to graduate in 4 years, and it defines itself as a four-year institution. Students also hear that they think full-time is 12 units because that's what you need to qualify for Pell Grants. In many instances, you can get a break on your car insurance if you're going 12 units. VA benefits sometimes are 12 units. So students hear that, they think that's full-time, and it's not. And these universities are struggling to, you know, gently reach out to them and say, hey, we need you to go 15. But then students have trouble getting the classes when they say, yeah, I'll do that.
I found that even the community college level, when I worked for many years at Pasadena City College when KPCC was located there, many students would describe themselves, oh, I'm taking a full load. And they were taking 12 units because they didn't understand the difference between being considered a full-time student and a full load. There was just the confusion you described at the CSUs.
Yeah, and it strikes me that one of the very biggest problems here is this, and it involves the community colleges. I had a bunch of students tell me that they simply don't have good, quick access to qualified counselors in the community college system, so they know precisely what kind of classes they need to take at specific institutions. So if they wanted to get into a certain department at San Diego State or San Jose State, you know, those might be a little bit different, and they need to know what that is. This has been a problem that has existed in the community colleges for years and years and years. And it's one of the reasons that that is preventing a lot of people from going to the community colleges for 2 years and then making the jump to the four-year schools. You know, that would save them so much money, but
yeah,
there's a fundamental problem within the community college system.
Cynthia Gopton says, I'm a high school counselor, and I have had students come back after graduation saying there's no support, no system in place to help them navigate the CSUs when they couldn't get classes. I think one solution to the problem is to assign incoming students mentors who would help them navigate the system. Well, that's supposed to be what the college counselors do, is that they sit down with a student and, you know, talk about all. But if the student can't get the classes that they need, I guess then they need to go back to the counselor and work out, you know, what the alternative is. Let's see. Let's talk with Henry in Pasadena. Good to have you with us. Henry, what's your experience?
Hi, I'm a student at Cal Poly Pomona. I was all set to graduate this semester in May, but when I was registering for classes last semester, I was unable to find the last class that I needed that fit in with my work schedule. So this led to me, I actually am graduating next semester in the fall instead of this spring. So.
Wow, because of one class. Now, in hindsight, do you think there's a way that you could have rejiggered your schedule to make it work? Or was that class the one that had to be the final class and there was really no way around what the position you found yourself in?
It was the one last class. It was a core class. And the reason it didn't fit in with my schedule is because it was right in the middle of the day. And I'm a server, so I work at night. And so it went to the evening, the middle of the day into the evening. So it just backed up the whole day for me.
And there are no other section of it available. Henry, I appreciate it. Thanks very much. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. David in Santa Monica, what's your experience? I understand you went to CSUN?
Yes, I went to Cal State Northridge. And the problem that I had was, you know, with my major, I did business, and there were so many prereqs. And so every time one of the prereqs was all filled up, I couldn't get to the next level. So it's just, it delays you an entire semester, and you just have to keep on waiting. And the real problem is that they give priority to, you know, the older graduates that maybe didn't plan their schedule. So the seniors have priority, the juniors have priority. So if you're trying to do it right and take your prereqs right away, you can't get into the classes.
And how long did it take you to get your degree?
It took me about 5.5 years.
Wow. And so that obviously cost you money as a result of that.
Sure it did. Thankfully, I was working full time.
David, I appreciate it. Thanks so much. 866-893-KPECC. Gary Robbins of the San Diego Union-Tribune. One of the things I recall at the community colleges, there was a real move, you know, the faculty associations really were pushing back against the number of adjunct faculty, the part-timers who were teaching. I don't know if that was the case with the CSUs as well, but if they cut the number of adjunct or didn't increase the number of adjunct and didn't increase the number of full-time faculty members, then they wouldn't have enough professors to be able to handle the demand. Has that gone on at the CSUs?
I'm not sure of the specific numbers, but it's an excellent question because the demand for classes, as everybody's been saying, is huge. The tenured faculty don't want to bring in more adjuncts, and the adjuncts want those jobs, and so there's a fundamental clash about who teaches what. But what we do know is that California's population has been growing about 1% per year for a long time. And higher numbers of high school graduates are graduating qualified to go to either a UC or a CSU. So the demand for classes is enormous. But there's an irony here. Even though more people are qualified for entrance, 40% of the people going to the CSU system need remediation. So it's chewing up a lot of professors' time having to teach people who need remediation.
Because they've done away with those non-credit remedial courses, right?
Well, they have, but here, what they don't know yet is whether the system will work. They only did that last fall, and what they did was they said, all right, you're going to take 4-credit courses, but we're going to provide you some tutoring if you need it, or we're going to allow you to take this course over 2 semesters. I'll stretch it out. That second part made me wonder whether that'll just increase class demand because you're stretching things out. You don't really stop remediation in a sense. You're just stretching it out. So the demand for classes is as high as it has ever been. They need to find a way to deal with that.
Layla in Fullerton, understand you were a Cal State Fullerton student body president. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Very good. When did you graduate?
I'm graduating this semester, actually.
Oh, you're still there. Great. And congratulations on that. So what are your thoughts about this, you know, being at the center of it?
So something that I noticed when I was president is that, yes, there's a lot of students, and yes, the administration is very aware that students have different circumstances coming into the Cal State system. But for some reason, I think it's disproportionate that some of the CSUs are ranked so difficult. For example, Cal State Fullerton is amongst the top 15 most difficult universities to get an A at by some algorithm developed by a Duke professor.
Wow.
Now, that seems kind of it doesn't make as much sense to me as it would for an Ivy League, for example.
Sure.
Because these students are going through so much, but the difficulty of their classes, their ability to succeed is lessened by the way that the classes are being taught. So that would, like, consequently affect their graduation rates. So if the professors and the school is taking so much pride in making the classes difficult, that is going to in turn lower the success rate because students aren't being provided the resources that they need.
Well, it's interesting because at so many other schools, the complaint is about grade inflation and that, you know, so few people get other than A's or B's at the university. You're describing Cal State Fullerton as more rigorous grading. What about the full-time status of 12 versus 15 or 16 units? Are students given clear information about that?
So generally, no, because if they take 12 units, they're generally paying as a full-time student. So that turns out to be a problem as well, because if the classes are so difficult and you end up taking more classes, then you're not going to pass all of your classes, and then you have to stay at school longer. So the whole system has it's riddled with a few flaws, and while most people are doing their best to compensate for that, there is some inherent difficulty in getting students out of the system in 4 years because there are so many different things wrong with the different steps.
So, Layla, you're graduating very soon here. How long in total has it taken you to get your degree?
It took me 5 years, but I am graduating with a minor. But I would say that's pretty much on track.
Yeah. Layla, thanks so much. And congratulations on your graduation coming right up. Layla, recently student body president, Cal State Fullerton. We have more listener calls to take. Also with us from the San Diego Union Tribune, Gary Robbins with an in-depth piece about the California State University's trying to speed up the process for their students to get through and graduate potentially within 4 years. We'll be back in 1 minute. Mike in Pasadena says he's a student at Cal State LA and has a lot of trouble getting classes. Sounds like he transferred from a community college. Said it was supposed to take him 2 years to graduate. He's into his third and said for him, a lot of it is the lack of online and night courses because he works full time while going to college. Ambika writes on the page, I'm a recent Cal State Fullerton graduate, got my degree in political science. My biggest struggle was finding courses I needed to take to get fulfilled degree requirements. Often registration for classes was determined by unit amount and GPA. Therefore, if you had a later registration date, classes you needed were already full, which delayed you at least a semester. Luckily, I graduated in 4 years, but I took summer courses to stay ahead and cost me an arm and a leg and had limited class selections. That's Ambika writing on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. By the way, the CSU campuses with the the lowest percentage of students graduating within 4 years. Cal State Los Angeles, 9.5% graduate within 4 years. Dominguez Hills, just over 11% graduate within 4 years. Cal State Northridge is at 15%. Cal State San Bernardino at 19%. Those are the lowest percentages of four-year student graduation rates among the California State University campuses. Let's see. Sean in Redlands, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Go right ahead, please.
Yeah, I actually had done my bachelor's degree at UC Riverside, and I had one class left. I took sign language as my foreign language, and we just needed the fourth level sign language. UC Riverside sent me to Cal State San Bernardino to take it because they just didn't offer it at all. And it took me just under 2 years to be able to find the class that I needed for it to be offered for me to graduate. So it almost extended my graduation 2 full years because the class just wasn't offered at all.
That's astounding. Now, you didn't consider changing the foreign language class so that you wouldn't have to wait 2 years?
Well, I didn't realize it was going to take that long. And then I started working. I needed to work. So I started working for the school system. And I assume my only option was to retake a language from the beginning.
Oh, okay.
It didn't make sense to me at all. If I would have known it would have taken that long, yeah, maybe I would have, because I took Latin in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Could have been an easy transition, but...
Yeah, but that would be in hindsight. Sean, I appreciate it so much. 2 year delay to get that one course. Let's talk with Ford, who joins us in Mission Hills in the Valley. You're on Air Talk.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks so much for doing this show. A lot of interesting topics you're covering.
Thanks.
I work with a nonprofit called Project Grad out in the Northeast Valley, working with thousands of public school students. And one of the challenges we face is that in LA Unified, there's still a ratio of roughly 600 or 700 students per trained college counselor in the high school. So the information students get is often very late for them, and often they can't even get to a counselor to get the information to make the choices about where they would go to matriculate onto college, community college, or a four-year institution.
Yeah, it's got to be so difficult to get the information. And so with students who have means, I assume they're looking at outside counselors.
Well, we've heard all about that in the news lately. Of course,
yeah.
They are. But there's lots of challenges in public education, which is where the bulk of the students from LA Unified that go to a four-year Cal State go to Cal State Northridge, for instance. But still, on the ground at the high schools in LA Unified, one of the wins of the recent strike, I noticed they said, was, no, this is great. We've gone from 700 students per counselor to 500 students per counselor. That's not, in my view, that's not a win. And we embed 12 staff at just one high school, San Fernando, to work with over 2,000 students in any given year at that high school. And it's still far from enough.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that, Ford. It sounds overwhelming. Ford in Mission Hills joining us. Sarah says, I'm a student at Cal State LA and an organizer against my administration's plan to declare our campus impacted rather than shutting out CSU qualified students at a time when higher ed's undoubtedly necessary for a decent career and future. Maybe our school should be demanding more state funding. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Gary Robbins, San Diego Union Tribune. Do you know, is there more money in the next budget for the CSUs to offer more classes?
Yeah, well, there's more money in the next budget. Governor Newsom gave the CSU a very large increase. I don't know what proportion is going to classes, but I think there's something we need to talk about. This is not just about the number of classes. It is about the type of classes. These universities are being flooded now with Generation Z. This is the first generation of people who always had the internet and social media. They want more online classes. The CSU has an online part. A lot of it is quite good. In some cases, you can take one class free. But if you talk to the students, they're saying, give us more. Let us take classes before we even get to the CSU. Help us do it more so that additional three units you say I need is an online class. So I've talked to a lot of professors who are kind of resistant to these online classes. You know, this cultural thing, it's a generational thing. But a student at UC San Diego told me when she arrives on campus, she tells professors in so many words, "I'm not here to serve you. You're here to serve me." And they are a plugged-in generation, a digital generation, and their needs need to be served. And colleges and universities are not shifting as quickly as they should, particularly at the public level.
Gary, I appreciate your being with us so much. Gary Robbins, San Diego Union Tribune reporter, who's written extensively on this issue of how long it takes CSU students to graduate. Fresh Air is next. Have a great afternoon.